Hollywood at 3 in the morning. Even now, deep into the night, Wilshire Boulevard looked wide awake and filled with light and energy. Nobody was on the sidewalks, but then people rarely were. Instead, they trundled around sardine-like in the metal capsules called automobiles, skimming past places like Simon's Drive-In at Wilshire and Fairfax, with its neon sign and glittering metal canopies, and girls in short skirts and ponytails, usually tripping from car to car, bearing burgers and shakes, snapping small metal trays onto the frames of open car windows. Julie felt she sailed between day and night, thinking of all the wonders of Los Angeles.
A wonderfully evocative description of Los Angeles as it appears to one of the main characters, Julie Crawford. And it's through Julie's situation that the novel unfolds. We follow the characters through the final months of the filming of Gone with the Wind. Why did you want to write this book?
Well, I've always loved Gone with the Wind. The book, the movie, it always drew me. And when I realized that the 75th anniversary of making Gone with the Wind was coming up, the thought that hit me was, wow, how can it be that this movie, if you say, I'm looking into Gone with the Wind, people's eyes light up and they say, oh, yes, I loved it. And you think, how did that hold so strong for 75 years? And I also felt drawn by the fact that I grew up in Los Angeles. The excerpt from the book that I just read is really very much a Los Angeles I remember. It was very in-your-face culture. And growing up there, you inhaled the movie culture. It was something that just was part of being in L.A. I certainly wasn't a Hollywood kid, and I certainly didn't grow up in Beverly Hills. But where else, what other city in the U.S. could a girl's father come home with the evening paper and she glances at the headlines and they're 4 inches high and heavy black letters saying, Liz has flu? And it never even occurs to her that that might be a bit of overkill.
Nothing works like excess.
Then I was still being drawn into this vortex of Gone with the Wind, and I began reading more about it and realized that it had a terrible number of problems. Instead of asking why has it survived for 75 years, the next question that I became intrigued with was, how did it ever get made? It was a mess, this huge, sprawling novel. The producer, Daniel O. Selznick, never did quite get a script together. He used to rewrite the script for every day of shooting. So it was the director he fired after 2 weeks. There was another director who had a nervous breakdown. It went on and on.
He was maniacal, it seemed.
I think that's the only kind of person who could have gotten Gone with the Wind made.
Because of his obsession with detail and perfection?
I really think so. He was adamant about costuming, about how the tails of the horses were clipped. Everything had to be true to the era, which, of course, poor Vivian Leigh complained about during the entire time of the making of the movie because she had to wear these thick, heavy corsets that pushed her up and she felt she could hardly breathe, but he insisted.
Well, the love story of Clark Gable and Carol Lombard is prominent in this book, and I can understand why. Carol Lombard seems so grounded. She's not only colorful and sensible, she's outrageous, but she seems like one who really could have survived in Hollywood were it not for her tragic death in a plane crash.
She just skipped out of the history books and onto my computer keys. I loved her. As soon as I was tracking Clark Gable, that, of course, took me very quickly to Carol Lombard. I think it's fair to say we might never have had the Rhett Butler we remember today if it hadn't been for Carol, because he didn't want to play that part. He was a very shy man in many ways, and she was so exuberant, honest, straightforward. She was always who she was, which must have been very hard in Hollywood. But she was, as you put it, rooted. She was anchored. And I felt that I could feel her sitting next to me as I wrote about her. That sounds a little silly, but...
No, I think they seemed that real in A Touch of Stardust. Did they really call each other Ma and Pa?
Yes, they did.
Boy, if ever there was a couple that did not resemble American Gothic, it would be the two of them.
Which might be exactly why they called each other Ma and Pa. I don't know.
Please, you don't interest me that way, really. Doesn't that hurt your pride?
No, you're much too pretty.
Oh, of course, I forgot. I promised Charlie I'd meet him at the dance.
Certainly. Why don't you go?
Because you fascinate me.
She had animals all the time. Carol was wonderful. She was, and he was wonderful with her. Whether that is a marriage that would have survived in Hollywood, who knows? But my conclusion was that it was quite true while it was there. I think it must have been very hard to lose her.
Oh, indeed. And it was for a noble cause. She was in the war bond effort, wasn't she?
Yes. In fact, the President of the United States named her as the first woman killed in service to her country in World War II.
Mm. Well, just as Los Angeles, and particularly Hollywood in the 30s, becomes an important character in your book, maybe the movie itself is the protagonist. And my goodness, the detail you have about the cynicism, the talk of doom surrounding the making of the movie. There was such a schadenfreude, if you will. It almost seemed that the press was eager for it to fail.
Yes, I think that's true. Gary Cooper was quoted a lot. He turned down the part and was quoted as saying that he sure was glad Clark Gable got it. He could fall on his face. So he must have eaten those words a dozen times over the course of his life.
Has the war started?
Sir, you should have made your presence known.
In the middle of that beautiful love scene? That wouldn't have been very tactful, would it? But don't worry. Your secret is safe with me.
Sir, you are no gentleman.
And you, miss, are no lady.
The heroine of my story is a young woman named Julie, who comes from the Midwest, and she wants to find fame and fortune in Hollywood. Sounds like an ordinary story, right? But she wants to be a screenwriter. And I wanted to bring that aspect of the history of women in Hollywood into my book, because women were very prominent as screenwriters and directors early in the history of the motion picture industry. And all of that changed, of course, as it became a more lucrative pursuit. But there was one amazing woman I ran across in my research named Frances Marion, and she was a top screenwriter in Hollywood. And today, nobody knows who she is.
Well, you make her a very endearing character. She essentially mentors Julie and helps her realize her talent. Julie also falls in love. There's kind of a parallel love story, hers with Andy and Carol and Clark. And Andy is a complex character. And you use his situation to talk about war looming in Europe.
Yes, I really felt that in writing about this era, you couldn't ignore what was gathering. This was the end of the golden era of Hollywood, though they didn't know it, and many in Hollywood were trying to ignore all the signs. And I wanted Andy to be a complicated person who knows, because he's Jewish, that things are different, and he has family overseas, and he feels that the war clouds over Europe are going to, not too far in the future, engulf the United States also. And this becomes part of the tension in his relationship with Julie and with the entire business of making movies.
There's a portion of the book where Andy describes an experience he has as a boy riding his bicycle in Berlin. And you give such a vivid account of the neighborhood. Did you draw upon a visit to Berlin for writing that?
No, I did not. I was not in Berlin, but I've read a great deal. What has always interested me is how human beings keep assuming that the ordinary will reassert itself at times of great stress. And I wanted to show how it was all changing and how easy it was to pretend it wasn't or believe it wasn't.
And you also bring out the fact that the movie moguls in Hollywood, who were Jewish themselves, were unabashed about continuing to do business with Germany during this time.
That's right. That was a deep shame of Hollywood. It wasn't all, of course, but there were several of the major players in Hollywood who did indeed just wish all this fuss would go away and let's get back down to business.
There is a lovely chapter in the book where we learn about a very classy writer, I'm quoting here, Herman Mankiewicz, and you give the address on Tower Road. And I just love this line, if you're looking for glamour, Oscar Hammerstein lives next door. If you're looking for intellect, you'll find it here. You have a personal connection to that address, don't you?
I do. I have a personal connection to the man who grew up in that house. He was my husband, Frank Mankiewicz, who died 4 months ago. And he would tell me tales. We would sit around the dinner table and he'd talk about what life was like at the Mankiewicz house. I really enjoyed hearing about these rather ordinary dinner guests, right?
Yeah, like
Scott Fitzgerald, the Marx Brothers, Helen Hayes, just the neighbors.
Did they really have a frog-shaped swimming pool?
Yes. At one point, I don't know if they still do, but Frank took me by the house and we saw that it was under renovation, but it was empty and open, so we tiptoed inside and walked around. And he could reconstruct how it had looked when he was living there. Showed me where his father worked, and we went out and he showed me the frog-shaped pool.
How special that must have been. Getting back to the filmmaking, it was very heartening to read. Well, now look, I'm looking at the book as though it's a historical account, but I think Clark Gable objecting to the separate toilets on the set, that was taken from real life?
Yes.
Why in Los Angeles would that have been an issue?
Well, I can't answer that definitively, but certainly the prejudice that existed was not solely in the South. It took a very courageous African-American extra to go to Clark's dressing room and knock on the door and asked to speak to him and tell him what was being done, why it was done. It was a mindless decision by someone, not clear who it was, but it was Clark who went roaring out and said if those signs weren't taken down, he was out of there. Selznick had them taken down very quickly. Mm.
And of course, you touch upon the racism surrounding the premiere of the film in Atlanta, which is legendary here. You described the thousands of people who lined the streets in Atlanta when the stars arrived for the premiere. These people wearing vintage Civil War uniforms and clothing, and there is such a romanticization of that period. It's very difficult for African Americans, I think, to deal with the affection for Gone with the Wind.
Yes, I think that has been a problem over all of these years. Although I went back to read in some of the African American press of the time, there were differing views as to whether or not Gone with the Wind was something that should be avoided or denounced or enjoyed for the parts of it that were part of the true history. I was surprised that there really wasn't a complete denunciation of Gone with the Wind. There were many blacks who were eager to see it. The romanticism of the movie, the ferocious fight against poverty. You know, remember, this was the tail end of the Depression. So it wasn't just the Civil War, I think, that made people gravitate to this movie at that time. It was also remembering the hardscrabble years that they themselves had just lived through.
Yeah. Indeed. More than a depiction of the Civil War, it's a struggle against adversity.
Yes. It's an interesting war movie that has not a single battle scene.
You have one of the greatest opening lines that I think I have read in years. Atlanta was exploding right on schedule.
Thank you. I wrote that sentence when I was thinking about writing the book, and I thought, that's the first sentence of the book.
Haven't left much for the Yankees to take, have we? We'll have to make a dash for it before the fire reaches that ammunition.
You write about how Margaret Mitchell's text was taken very seriously by Selznick and how important it was to stay true to the book.
It was, which made it very complicated because it was a huge, huge book. And Selznick became almost impossible, and he himself was into a lot of rewriting. They had to cut great chunks out. And Victor Fleming, the director who took over after the first director was fired, hadn't even read the novel.
That was shocking.
Neither did Ben Hecht, who was one of the screenwriters called in to try and fix up the mess that the whole thing had become. And poor Vivian Leigh, she would show up on the set every day with a tattered copy of the book and wave it around and say, no, 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 we can't do this. Look at page 252. And finally, at one point, Selznick exploded, apparently, and said to her, leave the damn book at home. But most of the language in the movie is true to the book. They just had to take so much out. But it was cohesive. It worked. It's just amazing that that movie worked. It still amazes me.
Really. And the music is so voluptuous. That score by Max Steiner, I appreciate that you included his hard work in your book.
Yes, there were so many people. If I were writing nonfiction, it would have been a lot more. Anytime I'm going to use a real person in a novel, I have to make sure I can answer in the affirmative the question, do they have a realistic place in the story? I mean, is this something where they are woven into the story, not just pasted on top?
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't work. I also loved the story of the first preview when they went off to the theater in Riverside and scared the manager out of his wits.
With how many?
They walked in with something like 56 cans of film.
Can you imagine? Now it's all digital. Well, I thank you for this beautiful experience that takes us there.
Well, thank you very much.